Does Jesus Christ Believe in Parties? Welcome to Pro. I'm Alden Thompson, your host for our discussion of John's Gospel this week. My conversation partners are Paul Dibdahl, Bruce Johansson, colleagues in the Ottawa College School of Theology. I'd like to just toss this question out to them. Is Jesus a party person? We're into second chapter of John, and I know I've loaded the decks because the text seems to suggest that he is. Now, would you... Are you willing to say amen to that?
I guess we have to. The text says so. He went to a wedding and he had fun. Yes. No, it to me, I really like this. This is one of the stories, and also the one about the woman caught in adultery, where Jesus is just so interesting in his interaction with people in different kinds of contexts. He can be so out of character in dealing with the woman caught in adultery, but here he's ready to enjoy this feast and to have a good time. In fact, he contributes to the good time.
It has struck me before, and this miracle story is an example of it. But it struck me before that it seems like Jesus. We just read about, you know, the Word becoming flesh in John chapter 1. And here in John chapter 2, the Word becoming flesh, it seems like God here on earth would really want to watch, you know, the passage of time very carefully, make use of every single moment. And yet we have him, we don't hear anything about him in John until he's an adult.
Right.
Where has he been all along?
Making tables and benches and boxes.
It seems to me to be a waste of time. and then his first miracle involves spending a week at a wedding. Apparently, a wedding feast, which would be typically about a week long.
Our Puritan heritage cries out against that, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, yet there's something wonderful about that, too.
Oh, it is. Yeah. We are so driven by the clock. Got to make sure that we get this done by yesterday. See, and just driving on, and here Jesus goes and just kicks back for a whole week. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, there's one key feature of this story, is that Jesus gives the best wine at the end. I think he's maybe having some fun here, but there's a serious purpose, Bruce, that you were mentioning here, that this is water of purification.
Yeah. And Jesus, the jars are huge, so they would be there for...
For purification.
For purification.
And Jesus takes away all their water of purification and does what with it?
Turns it into wine. Grape juice, maybe.
Whatever it was, when he tasted it, he said, "This is marvelous."
Yeah.
Now, see, given the Adventist preference for pure grape juice, mm-hmm. I've suspected that, I don't know what time of year this was, but, you know, when you bring, if he had created pure grape juice, and when the host taste the pure grape juice, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
We don't know what it was. The point was that he recognized that this was superior to anything they'd had during the feast.
That's right. See? I think there's an underlying message.
Yeah.
When you hear that message and you know that these huge pots represented keeping water for ceremonial purification, the message is Jesus has brought something far better, and it's his blood that can truly purify. But that doesn't come. The reader sort of... Here's this. Modern-day readers probably wouldn't even catch this, but Jewish readers would. And they would tuck that away, and, of course, the fullest meaning would come when they get a little bit further down in the gospel.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you see, John's gospel is being written after the temple has been destroyed.
That's right.
And the whole Jewish ritual system was really kind of in chaos.
Yes.
So the readers would be ready to hear this message.
Yeah.
That it really was even replaced in the process of being replaced when Jesus was here.
And this water is not something you wash your body with. It becomes wine, which you take into your very being.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe that's pushing it too hard, seeing too many things in the text. But John does this.
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
Now, there's a story there which is intriguing because the wording of it sounds so very almost hostile in the old translations.
It does, yeah.
And I'm not sure how one can turn that around so that it sounds appropriate. We, of course, all we have is the written word.
Oh, woman, what have you to do with me?
See, the New International Version softens it for us a bit. Jesus addresses his mother as, "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" is the way they translate
it. Yeah.
But you know, one of the things that we're missing in the Gospels is the voice nuance.
Yeah.
I think of one phrase, and I've often used this as probably the most precious words on earth and also the most angering words on earth.
Yeah.
"I'll be praying for you."
Yeah.
You know, when I sense that someone has my best interests in heart and says, "I'll be praying for you," that just melts my soul.
Yeah. It has the right intonation.
Yeah. But somebody can come back and finish up a conversation, "I'll be praying for you." Exactly the same words, and I am angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's one way of just trying to finish the conversation. So we don't know whether Jesus was saying, "Well, mother."
From more recent studies, we've found that actually "woman" is an endearing way of referring to mother. So dear woman would be right on.
Not a literal translation, but certainly capturing probably the nuance of what was intended there. Yeah.
Now, I have an interesting PS which may be of interest, especially to those who are Seventh-day Adventists and may be familiar with Ellen White's commentary. In her earlier writings, she interprets this as being a rebuke of Mary's sinful pride.
Hmm.
But when it comes to her magnum opus on the life of Christ, Desire of Ages, she talks about a fond mother's natural pride and sees this as being just polite. So as her own perspective has changed, the way she tells the story changes as well.
Yeah.
Now, I probably wouldn't have been prepared to hear that if I hadn't done some study with the four Gospels. When you see the same story told in such different ways, you have the historical kernel.
Yeah.
But one may have a more sharp tone, one may have a more gentle tone, and there are all kinds of reasons for that.
That's right.
Now, there's another aspect here, which is, well, there are two things that I want to talk about before our clock runs out on us. What about the role of miracles and belief? John's Gospel is quite clear. He says this first of his signs, and it's supposed to help people believe. Does it?
Hmm.
The miracles?
Miracles are a modern problem.
What do you mean? What do you mean when you say that?
I think miracles were quite widely accepted in the ancient world. Jesus talks about the Pharisees' disciples performing miracles. I do think that it wasn't as much a problem back then as it is today. We have science. We are explaining the world with all our scientific knowledge.
Yeah.
So if something doesn't fit into our explanation, it's a problem. I don't know.
Well, that's very true. And, of course, in the new so-called Philip Jenkins book, where he talks about the new Southern Christianity, Africa, Asia, South America, these people don't have problems with miracles at all.
No.
In fact, they see them all the time.
Right.
So I think it's important. But in terms of modern people, or even in my own life, maybe I could ask that, to what extent does a miracle make a permanent difference in my life? A supernatural one, you know, a voice, a light, something like that. I thought about that. And I don't know. I think John's trying to, he records these, but I think he is really pointing the direction, as he says to Thomas at the end of the book, "Blessed are those who have believed without seeing."
That's right.
See?
Yeah. In fact, I think miracles back in those days in Jesus' use was not so much to impress with the spectacular, but rather to underline a message that he was trying to get through. It was communicative rather than wow, you know. All his miracles had content to them.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just done to overpower people.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one last incident in this cluster here, and in fact, it's two striking stories side by side. You have the party person, and then Jesus goes and cleanses the temple, and you see his flash of anger there. Now, a whole lot of nasty anger has been justified by
Unfortunately,
Jesus.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But what do you men see as significant the way Jesus handled his anger here? Any comments on that?
This isn't directly answering the question, but just to affirm again, in some ways, I wish this passage was not used as often as it is, because I can think of a number of times in my own life where people have, again, justified their behavior, out of control behavior sometimes, mm-hmm. and simply mm-hmm. called it, well, I guess, you know, it's just a question of righteous indignation, so I'm being like Jesus.
Yeah.
So there is, I think we do need to look at this carefully.
Yeah. One of the things that I have noticed when looking at this is in reconstructing the historical background, this buying and selling was probably going on in the court of the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
You had the temple, the court of the priest and the men, the women, then you had the outer court of the Gentiles. The priestly family were in control of that business. They changed money because people who came from all over the world to worship they couldn't pay the temple tax in their currency, mm-hmm. and the rate of exchange was exorbitant. Mm. They had to buy sacrificial animals. Even a dove was 70 times the price of a normal dove because it had to be a perfect one. These guys were ripping people off. There was a huge amount of injustice going on.
And this is where Jesus' message would tie in exactly in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
You know, you have taken advantage of innocent people.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then I wonder if there isn't an undertone that being in the court of the Gentiles, it kind of made them less important than the Jewish people.
Mm.
I don't know. Maybe that's a wild guess. Yeah. But I know John does a lot of these undertone, these mm-hmm. meanings within meanings. Mm-hmm. And Jesus cleared them out because that was going to be a place where Gentiles could worship.
Mm-hmm. You know, the anger, and sometimes we make Jesus so gentle that we overlook the fact that there are some evils in the world that require an outburst of anger.
Yeah.
If we're not angry, something is wrong.
That's right.
But there was something amazing about Jesus' anger. And it's one of the other Gospels that brings this out, the cleansing of his temple at the end of his ministry. That when Jesus got angry, all the adults fled, but the children came running. I would love to have that kind of anger. No, normally children head for the hills when adults get angry.
Yes.
But here, Jesus got angry at the adults, and the children came running to him.
That's a wonderful thought.
It's just amazing.
I think usually we become angry at a personal affront, and it seems to me that in this case, Jesus' anger.
Yes.
You know, based on what was said, it's on behalf of other people, those that are being ripped off, essentially, by the establishment. And he's protecting them. His anger is it's an act of kindness toward them, actually.
And if we could be sure that our anger was in defense of others instead of our own wounded self-concept, I think it would be much safer.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
One last comment here before we finish. John's cleansing of the temple comes at the beginning. The synoptics have at the end. What do we make of that? Was there one cleansing or two, or do we know?
We probably don't know.
We probably don't know. Yeah.
I think the interesting thing here is that what comes after this is that Jesus points to he gives this kind of dark saying, destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it up. And he's referring to himself, which goes back to chapter 1.
Uh-huh.
He dwelt with us, the incarnation, picks up that theme again. And one could say in a way that in the story of the wedding, the Jewish system of purification is done with. Here, the temple is.
And that's an important conclusion. Now, next time we'll come to this conversation with Nicodemus. That will happen next time. Paul and Bruce will both be with me again. We look forward to that. Our time is up for this time. My thanks to Steve Cochran, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Pro, I'm Paul Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you may call 509-527-2194 or email probe@wwc.edu. Join us again next week at the same time for Probe.